So the blockade was the first international crisis of the Cold War. It lasted about a year. We're going to talk about how we got to airlift supplies in there. And the Soviets basically said they would withdraw the blockade. They'd take it down if the West would get rid of the Deutschmark, the German money. It's strange. But we'll get into Giles Milton and your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. So our troops, Giles, are there. They're in the western section of Berlin. They have no food, no nothing. We decide to start airlifting. What happens?
So, yeah, they decide. It's decided to try and bring food and fuel into the city, not only to support the Western garrison troops, the Americans and Brits and French who are there, but also 2.5 million Berliners who've got no food, no supplies. Now, this is where Frank Howley plays a massive role, because he knows that West Berlin requires about 5,000 tons of food and fuel every single day. But here's the problem. A Dakota, the famous Goonie Bird plane, can only carry 2.5 tons of food and supplies. So they realize it's going to be almost impossible to supply the city by air. And yet, there is simply no other option. Stalin has closed the road and rail links into Berlin, into the western sectors. They have to fly everything in. And thus begins one of the greatest sort of operations run by the American military in history, I think. Absolutely unbelievable for a year to keep a city alive just by using these little Dakota planes.
What finally got the blockade to be lifted?
Well, it almost went horribly wrong, because in the winter of 1948-1949, the fog came down, there was snow, there was ice. And, you know, for the Berlin airlift to work, to supply this many people with that much food, they needed planes. They were flying in at five different levels, at intervals of a few hundred feet, landing every 90 seconds into Berlin. It was an astonishing operation, and the weather almost blew it apart.
Well, but what you're saying is they had to fly into East Germany. Would the Soviets considering shooting any of them down?
The great worry was, would Stalin order his forces to shoot them down? They never shot at them, but what they did is they try and blind the pilots with these powerful lights, searchlights up into the sky. They take pot shots between the planes as they were coming into land. It was really, really dangerous thing to do. The pilots were just unbelievably heroic to fly into Berlin, you know, as I say, landing every 90 seconds into Berlin's two airports in West Berlin, bringing in these essential supplies to the city. But the weather nearly did for them in the winter, and the airlift almost ground to a halt. But luckily, they kept it going. They brought in an increasing number of supplies. And I think by Easter 1949, Stalin realized that the West could pull this off, and he'd lost, and he had to backtrack and call off the blockade.
And once they did, that was in 1949, and things stayed tense ever since, didn't they?
They did indeed, yeah. But I think one should salute the kind of heroism of the American-British pilots flying into Berlin, because nothing like this had ever been done before in history. What the Americans did and the British did, they gathered every single available plane from across the world and brought in these planes into West Germany. And, it was an amazing aerial operation. And I don't think it gets talked about enough, because this was a moment of, just logistically, it was a triumph. But also in terms of just human resources, it was just an incredible thing that was pulled off.
Yeah, at that time they had Douglas C-54s, which were four-engine props, big planes, and they flew in. Thank God we didn't have surface-to-air missiles at the time.
Exactly. But the big planes only came in slightly later in the airlift. At the beginning, they only had these Dakotas, which were tiny,
And, oh, yeah.
And, they'd already been through the Second World War. They were dented. They were, had holes in them from bullet holes and everything. These were at the end of their lifespan, and they were being used to keep the western sectors of Berlin alive.
When the wall finally came down in, that was when, 1989,
1990? Yeah,
89,
yeah.
Did the two Germanys meet up right away?
Well, there was a debate about what should happen next. In fact, the British Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, was dead against Germany reuniting. She'd grown up during the war. Her fear was, once again, here we have a very, very powerful Germany. But I think Germany had changed by then. And, anyway, it was the German people that decided to reunite the country. And it happened with remarkably smoothly, actually. Obviously, the West took a big economic hit to bring the East up to the same level financially and economically, but it happened quite swiftly.
What's so amazing about war, Giles, is you can have countries like Japan and Germany, who were our arch enemies 70 years ago, and now they're all friends.
Yeah. I mean, how the world changes. And but I think what's really, I mean, you could take that back to 1945, that within a few months of the Americans and British fighting against Germany, they suddenly find they're on the same side as the Germans, and the Russians, who they've been fighting with, are the enemies. I mean, how quickly these alliances shift is extraordinary.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to David in Houston, Texas, to get us started. Hey, Dave, go ahead.
Good morning, and love the show. I have a question regarding some flights that were shot down, some Korean airlines. I think one was a flight 902 in the 78, and the other one was a flight 007 in 83. And I was going through some Wikipedia, and, I take it for, what it's worth, but it says that was a conflict related to the Cold War, and I was just wondering what your opinion would be on that and how
all right.
It relates.
Did you track that at all, Giles, those flights?
That's no, because that's sort of outside the scope of my book, but I think it will have been a Cold War, incident. There were so many flashpoints, and everything was so tense, and everyone was sort of looking over each other's shoulder at what the other people were doing, that so many things could be misconstrued. And, we came so close to war. Obviously everyone will know about the Cuban Missile Crisis and everything. We were so close to war at so many periods during this long stretch of Cold War that really it's a miracle it never happened. And any one incident, like a shooting down of a plane, and there were several were shot down during the Cold War, could have sparked an incident. But thank God the powers that be held back from pressing the nuclear trigger.
Would you say we're in a Cold War now with Russia, Giles?
Funny enough, the Russian ambassador to Britain was asked that question recently, and he said relations have never been more frosty. I think, I think the West is in a very uneasy standoff with Putin and his regime. What Putin's done in Ukraine and the Crimea is appalling. What his silencing of opposition leaders inside his own country is appalling. And, of course, directly implicated in my own country, in Great Britain, where he sends in his agents to kill people, kill his own citizens inside in Britain. This has caused real friction between the British government and Putin's government.
Poisoning, right?
You look at them, and sometimes they look like a band of gangsters running Russia at the moment.
Jeez, interesting take. Let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, Giles, a couple of questions. Giles, great show. One would be George Orwell coined the phrase, I believe, in an article or publication, The Cold War, and he wrote, of course, 1984. So even without a massive global nuclear exchange, there was lots and lots of dystopia all over the place. Even the fact that we supposedly supplied Stalin with 100,000 planes, then we're against them. There's all sorts of the Great Escape with Steve McQueen, all these individual stories of really personal dystopia. So how do you see the dystopian aspects of all this as it traveled along, and maybe some secret societies that were behind it? And also, the second question would be about those proposals like Operation Unthinkable or Operation Claudio. What were some of the things on the table that were really crazy that maybe didn't get executed?
Yeah, I think I'm glad you mentioned Operation Unthinkable, actually, because this is one of the craziest things in my book and one of the craziest things I came across. And for people who are not familiar with it, this was Churchill's plan, astonishing plan, in 1945, just at the end of the war, to attack the Soviet Union. He wanted to take the American army, the British army, the Canadians, and launch a massive assault on Stalin's Russia. And when it was pointed out that they didn't have the forces, there were not enough troops on the western side to attack the Soviet Union, he just said, well, let's just turn the German army around and use them as well. Not only just the German army, but the SS as well, who'd committed all these atrocities. He wanted to rearm them, bring them on the side of the Western powers, and attack Stalin's Russia. One of the most unbelievable stories from the very end of the Second World War. God knows what would have happened if he'd gone ahead with that.
Absolutely.
On your earlier points, the dystopia and everything can be seen within Berlin, where you have spies and agents working underground, undercover. The Americans had tons of spies in Berlin, the Brits too, and they were going into Soviet territory, looking around, snooping, trying to gather intelligence. Fascinating stuff, you know, all that whole, the intelligence wars between the various powers.
How long did General Howley stay as the administrator of that section for us?
He was there from 1945 through to 1949. And 1949 is really a sort of key date in the Cold War because, of course, this is when NATO is established. And this is where the powers in Europe with America come together. And the central tenet of NATO is that an attack on one power is an attack on all of them. And this is a major change in the Cold War because it means if the Soviet Union dares to attack one country in Europe, it has the whole might of NATO against it. And I think this is what leads to the uneasy standoff, which will become the hallmark of the Cold War from that point on.
West of the Rockies, Bill is with us. Byron's with us in Murrieta, California. Hi, Byron. Thanks for calling.
Good evening, gentlemen. I believe you're remiss, sir, Mr. Giles, if you will, in being negligent and not mentioning the Hungarian Revolt of 1956. I also want to chime in about FDR, maybe Churchill as well, having sold out that country to Stalin. But what did the West do for Hungary in 1956? I'm Hungarian descent, as I believe Chris Boros is as well.
Yes, you're right. So what about Hungary? Where do they fit into the equation, Giles?
I think this is one of the more shameful episodes of the Cold War. The British and Americans did nothing to help out Hungary. And likewise, there were many uprisings in many of the countries effectively run by the Soviet Union. And the West did nothing. By then, it had been kind of accepted that the Soviet Union had control over those countries that they'd overrun at the end of the Second World War, and that Stalin and the leaders that followed him were given free rein to do whatever they wanted in those countries. It's a pretty shameful episode in history, I think, in terms of the West, but the West did not want to provoke a nuclear war, and they saw this uneasy standoff that was the Cold War as better than going into a head-to-head conflict with the other powers.
General Patton recommended that we destroy the Soviet Union when we had our chance. Was he right?
Well, that's exactly what Churchill thought as well, and this is going back to Operation Unthinkable. I think General Patton was unusual. I don't think many American generals would have gone along with that. President Roosevelt certainly wouldn't have gone along with it. But Patton always took a kind of hawkish approach to things, and he had a supporter in Winston Churchill on that.
How did they rebound after losing 27 million Soviets?
You know, the Soviet Union was kept alive during the Second World War by the American Lend-Lease program, which, again, is not spoken about much, but America poured billions of dollars and of military hardware, of tanks, of guns, of equipment into the Soviet Union. They were, of course, shipped over on the Atlantic convoys and also brought up through Iran into the Soviet Union. This is overlooked, and that kept the Soviet Union going during the war. And came to a swift end at the end of the war, and Soviet Union had a very hard time to rebound economically from the destruction wrought on it by the Nazi war machine.
Giles, in your opinion, why can't Earthlings simply get along? Why did they go to war? I mean, why can't they just work things out?
You know, sometimes if you left it to the common people like myself, we get on with people. You go to a foreign country, you get on with people. You share a beer with them. You know, it's great. The problem is you get these monsters at the top of the tree running the show, Hitlers, Stalins, and
the
they
sweep
all along with them, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's crazy. Let's go to our first-time caller, Robert, in Albany, New York. Welcome to the program, Robert. Go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a good fan of your show.
Thank you, Robert.
The reason I called is I wanted to share some experiences with my trip to the Berlin Wall.
Okay, love to hear it.
Yeah, I was stationed in the 3rd Armored Division, which is Patton's old outfit. Of course, that was after his time. This was in the 1960s. And our commanding general found out that we were going to have a football game with the Berlin Brigade. So he commandeered a train, and he said, well, fill it up with all the GIs and bring them into Berlin. So we had a nice weekend in Berlin. And one of the things that we did when I was there, Berlin Brigade had a tour bus that went into East Berlin. And that was through Checkpoint Charlie.
Uh-huh.
And we saw what was on the other side, and it was kind of dismal. You know, I can understand you were talking before about the why the East Germans wanted to come over to West Berlin.
They couldn't wait. You know, they couldn't wait to get out of East Berlin, could they?
Yeah. So we passed by. We saw the Russian version of the unknown soldier, and also we went to a massive war memorial, which was actually a mass grave, which buried both Germans and Russians from the battle. And all around the landings there were monuments to Joe Stalin.
That's amazing history right there. Lots of history there, Giles.
There is, and I find it's quite odd when you go to Berlin today that these bits of Cold War, sort of leftover bits, have now become huge tourist attractions. So everyone wants to go to Checkpoint Charlie and have their photo taken next to the famous sign, you know, you're now leaving the American sector. Everyone wants to go and see the few bits of the Berlin Wall that have been left up as tourist attractions. You know, these flashpoints of the Cold War have become on every tourist itinerary.
Interesting. Give us your website, Giles, if you would, sir, and where we can get your book, Checkmate in Berlin.
It's simply GilesMilton.com. So www.GilesMilton.com.
And we get your book Amazon or where else?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any good bookstore.
What are you working on next, Giles?
I'm looking at Stalin and the Brits and Americans working inside Moscow alongside Stalin as an ally during the Second World War. It's an amazing story.
Well, we'll have you back on when that's done. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to take a little walk on the paranormal side on Coast to Coast, of course, so make sure you're part of the program. We're going to come back with Giles Milton and take final phone calls. His work is called Checkmate in Berlin. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our final segment with Giles Milton as we talk about his work, Checkmate in Berlin, the Cold War showdown that shaped the modern world. I was thinking we did a show, and we've done shows, Giles, on the Kennedy situation. And he was really in office during a very tense time period, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think this was probably the tensest point of the Cold War, the episode of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, this is really the point where we were staring down nuclear war. This is the point where the world could have just gone mad, and we'd be living in a very different place if that had happened then.
Yeah, absolutely. But he and Khrushchev were able to get together and iron things out. My gosh.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, Khrushchev also, he came to Britain, actually, during the time of his premiership, because he wanted to try and reset the Cold War and try and make it slightly less dangerous. And thankfully, that was achieved. We didn't end up in a nuclear conflict.
His son, Sergei, moved to the United States and just passed away. He was living in Rhode Island.
Yeah, you know what? I heard an interview with him recently, which he recorded was shortly before he died. I had no idea he'd gone over to America. As did, of course, I think Stalin's daughter, Svetlana. She ended up living in America, didn't she?
And what does that tell you about this great country, huh?
Yeah, it's sure better than beats living in Russia, I guess.
It sure does. Let's go to the phones. Wildcard line, Bill is with us in Los Angeles. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Hi, George and Giles.
Hi.
Hi.
Giles, based on what we learned in 1991 after Soviet files were opened about their nasty plans, for example, to poison U.S. water supplies during the Cold War, how do you view claims and books arguing that President Roosevelt was slowly poisoned by Stalin's agents on FDR's medical team and that Stalin possibly orchestrated the car accident that killed General Patton?
Interesting. Too interesting.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, these conspiracy theories are always absolutely fascinating, partly because we probably will never get to the bottom of them and we'll never find out what's true and what's not. Often I find that conspiracy theories have a grain of truth in them, even if they're not completely true. But I don't buy the poisoning water and stuff. I don't know. For me, it just seems too far-fetched. Yes, there were all sorts of trickeries going on. Yes, there was bugging, there was spying, all sorts of stuff like that. But I don't know. For me, that stretches it too far.
And then what about Patton's car crash?
Well, that's... I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to say about that, George, to be honest. Possible. There's just not enough information, you know. Until something comes out of the files, and until we have some sort of paperwork that definitively nails this down, we just can't say it's true or not.
To Louisville, Kentucky, Louise is with us. Hi, Louise. Go ahead.
Thank you, George, for accepting my call.
Oh, you're welcome,
Louise.
I have
been to Germany twice and seen the Berlin Wall and also the piano of Beethoven. But my question is about the European nations. Does your guest know why the 12 European nations decided to carve up Africa and take a part of it for themselves?
I don't know. Giles, you want to answer that?
Well, I mean, this is the period of colonialism where the Western powers, I think, thought they could do pretty much whatever they wanted. They had the military might to do so. They had the money to do so. And they had the, you know, wherewithal. And sure, they carved up not just Africa, vast chunks of the world. I mean, look at the British Empire. It was a third of the world was run by Britain at one point in the 19th century. It's pretty crazy. And, of course, Churchill, at the end of the Second World War, his prime goal was to preserve the British Empire. And here he did not see eye to eye with President Roosevelt, who wanted the British Empire dismembered. He wanted these countries to become independent countries. And this was one of the points at which Churchill and Roosevelt were really in conflict. They did not see eye to eye about this.
I have a little piece of the Berlin Wall, and I guess I should save that until the end of time, huh?
You're so lucky. I wish I had a piece. Do you know what? My great aunt was one of the first people into Hitler's bunker, and she had a piece of Hitler's desk, which he had this red marble desk, and she smashed the piece off, and she used it as a paperweight in her house. And it was always meant to be come to me when she died, and alas, it never did. So I never got out. I got that little lump of rather sinister treasure.
I tell you what I'll do for you, my friend. After the show, I'm going to have you give Tom your mailing address in London because you're there most of the time.
Yeah.
When I get back to St. Louis where the little piece is hidden away, I'm going to send it to you as a Christmas present.
You are unbelievably generous. That is fantastic. George, you're a star.
We'll do that. You'll get a kick out of that. Next up, Port Angeles, Washington. Tom's with us. Go ahead, Tom.
Hello, gentlemen. On the Patton issue, he was aware that we had been pumping fighter aircraft and medium-range bombers out of New York, Bell P-39 Air Cobras and P-63s, along with some Mitchell bombers. And the Russians were making very good use of them. And this went on with the Lend-Lease program, which we never got any of this stuff back, of course, from the Russians. We lost a lot of people flying those aircraft from New York to Alaska to Siberia to get them to Moscow. And there was another supply line that went up on top of the Sokov Islands, and they brought in some of those aircraft in crates and just a whole lot of stuff we gave them, and ammunition for them and everything. Nobody ever talks about Lend-Lease programs and how bad the Russians treated us and our efforts there, and, you know, not to mention other things about World War II, like Rudolf Hess crashing his short-range bomber into England and trying to get a hold of the aristocracy. There's lots to know about World War II that has been really, really suppressed. So, anyway, your thoughts on that, sir?
Yeah, I'm really, really pleased you have raised this, actually, because this is exactly what I'm looking at for my new book. I think the whole story of Lend-Lease, the monumental effort made by America to keep Russia supplied with fighter planes, with tanks, and with ammunition, has just not been covered by anyone, any of the history books. And it's a remarkable chapter of America's history. And I want to do justice to that, because, like you say, the guys on the ground, they were treated appallingly, and yet they were keeping the Soviet Union alive and in the war. And I think their sacrifices deserve to be much better known. And I'm certainly going to try and do that in my next book.
Taking final calls here with Giles Milton as we talk about his work, Checkmate in Berlin. John in Ohio. Go ahead, John. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'd like to offer something by a former State Department official, William Bloom. It's B-L-U-M. And he is, since his disgust with the what he called the war crimes of the United States, he's had a file called William Bloom's Empire Files, in which he has documented, for instance, many cases with the United States as being the initiator of aggression, the provoker of aggression around the world, whereas the United States government media has reversed the sequence. You had somebody on a couple months ago, Dan Kovalik, wrote the book, The Plot to Control the World. I think he only got through the censors because he eliminated the U.S. plot to control the world, which was really what he was trying to say in the body of his very good book. By that, he points out, along with William Blum, that the United States was occupying half of a communist country militarily, politically, and economically. It would be like occupying Washington, New York, and Chicago by the Soviet Army.
Well, as you know, John, the United States is not perfect. It has made a lot of mistakes, but I'd rather be here than in Russia, wouldn't you, Giles?
I certainly would, yeah. I agree. You know, America, look at my own country, Britain. I mean, we've got a lot of mistakes have been made in the past, but it's good to talk about them. It's good to write about them. It's good to discover about them, and that way we could do better in the future.
Absolutely. Jeremy's with us in Jamestown, North Dakota. Welcome to the program. Hi, Jeremy. Go ahead.
Giles, I'm wanting to have a discussion about my damaged brain wrapping around I'm alive as a result of Hitler.
What do you mean you're alive as a result of Hitler?
Well, my grandfather fought in World War II, and he went over to Russia. He met my grandmother. She had a boy and three girls. One of those girls was my mother, and I was born because of my mother and father.
Well, what does Hitler have to do with it, Jeremy?
Well, if Hitler wouldn't have started the war, my grandfather wouldn't have gone to Russia.
Okay. That's a stretch, but I'll give you that. That's possible. I guess in some sick way, Hitler did something good for somebody.
I was going to say, George, that's one positive thing we can say about Hitler is he gave Rose to a new life there.
Former President Trump came into a lot of heat over the last week when he said that Hitler had done some good things. I'm not sure what he did that was good, particularly, other than the, you know, did what he did. He was evil.
He was evil, and there's nothing that can be said to defend him, I think.
No, you can't defend him. He was diabolical. Something happened to that guy. What would make somebody so evil?
But he was also, in some ways, he was also stupid in the sense that by invading the Soviet Union, he brought doom on himself because he was never, ever going to win that battle. Once America was in the war, Hitler was doomed. He was doomed to lose.
Had he stayed allies with the Soviet Union and not entered and attacked, what do you think would have been the outcome of World War II on the German side?
Well, that would have placed my own country in a very, very difficult situation.
Absolutely.
Britain was on its knees already in 1940, kept alive, really, by American support. It really, everything would have hinged on what President Roosevelt would have done. I think we needed the Americans. We couldn't survive alone, and so we were completely dependent on American backing.
And wasn't Germany very close to developing its own atomic bomb?
Well, they say that, but actually they were quite a long way off. And I think in 1945, they were nowhere near as advanced as the American nuclear program. I think it would have taken them many years to get a nuclear bomb. Don't forget, they killed many of their best scientists because they were Jewish. So they didn't have the expertise.
Next up, let's go to Eric, truck driving in Indiana. Hello, Eric.
Hello, George. How you guys doing?
Okay, my friend. Good.
Good deal. I just want to make a comment. You know, we've had some really good presidents, and I wanted to get back to Kennedy. He was one of them that was a hero twice in my book. And you know, he saved them guys on the boat, and he actually on that missile crisis, too. But I think that Donald Trump, you know, both of them two guys there got snuffed out, you know, they really did too early, I think. And if it would have been stretched out a little longer, we'd have gotten what we was moving forward to, you know. I just want an opinion on that.
All right, Giles, what do you think of that? Were you able to hear him okay?
It was a bit difficult to hear. Kennedy, yeah, one of the great presidents. Trump, you know, he's in my own country, in Europe, he's not so well viewed. So difficult to comment on that. What I would say is that America has some brilliant people working behind the scenes who very rarely get mentioned. The diplomats, your people in embassies who are studying things on the ground, bringing back intelligence into the White House. These are the people who are keeping the show on the road for many of the presidents, and they're unacknowledged, the work that they do, and they should be saluted.
Next up, let's go to, well, yeah, we got time for maybe one more quick call. Let's go to Tom in Riverside, California. Thomas, go for it.
Hello, George. I wanted to ask your guest about the, what's his opinion on what crept in after World War II and Joseph McCarthy. I really think he got a bad rap. I think he was looking at Hollywood and seeing the New World Order and mistaking it for communists.
Well, I think you're right about that. McCarthy was a paranoid person who got carried away, and, you know, it did him in eventually. Did you ever follow that, Giles?
Not so much, but I mean, I suppose this is where it's interesting where, you know, you've had the whole wartime, America's been told that Russia and the Soviet Union, the communist Soviet Union, is an ally, and then suddenly this ally goes to becoming an enemy, and this feeds all sorts of paranoia, which is perfectly represented in McCarthy, I think, yeah.
Absolutely. Giles, I'm going to put you on hold, get Tom your address, and I'll get you the Berlin Wall little stone, okay?
You're so kind, George. Thank you so much indeed.
That's Giles Milton, the name of his book, Checkmate in Berlin. It's fascinating. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to take a little walk on the paranormal side in the second half of the program. In the first half, we're going to be talking about you. So stay with us. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.